This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1-3 and 7-day passes. Watch The Chase for the Cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
Welcome to NetFront Presence. I'm Jeff Gordon of the Post-Dispatch, joined by the Post-Dispatch beat writer Matthew DeFranks in the pre-draft edition of the NetFront. So let's jump right to it. I'm going to put Matt on the spot immediately. You're Kyle Davidson. You've got the second overall pick. Sure, you've got a great center. You could probably use a cornerstone defenseman. But what do you do with that pick? It certainly seems to have been a little more intrigued now with what could happen after the first overall pick.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically down to what Demidov and Lushinov, right? And I would lean very, very slightly towards Lushinov just because of how rare it is to find defensemen like that, that are big, mobile, can contribute offensively, play defensively, physically, and is a right-handed shot. So like those attributes in itself kind of are rarer to find than dynamic forwards, which are still a very important piece. But I would lean very slightly towards Levshinov. And I think, honestly, part of that is maybe the bias of having seen him in person when the Michigan State was playing out at Centene in their regional. And maybe the one of the plays that he made to tie the game up late in the game for Michigan State. So I would lean towards him, but it's not a slam dunk by any means from my perspective.
Yeah, he's an easy guy to pick. He's got a big personality. He's been in the U.S. for a while. He's very good with the more than good with the language. He's a guy that's going to plug and play because of his maturity level. And, I think hard to pass up on that. On the other hand, the intrigue of the Russian factor never being more severe than it is now, given all the unrest in our world. But, you know, you got a great agent, Milstein, who knows how to market his guys. He changed the dynamic somewhat by inviting people to meet with his client. And that meeting went well, or meetings went well. You know, he's going to come to the NHL. You're seeing the Flyers get their guy to the NHL this year. Do you think there's a chance that somebody will trade up for that spot to take him and allow the Blackhawks to slide back and take a D-man? Because there are other D-men, maybe not the same level, but there are going to be really good D-men, right side D-men that are going to be available.
Yeah, it's I've seen reporting saying that the Blackhawks aren't moving from two. So yeah, I'm not plugged into the Blackhawks organization, obviously. I don't know what they plan on doing, but I guess it's worth a question, right? You wonder if they can move back to three or four and still get the same guy if a team wants to move up to get Demidov. But I thought it was a nice move from as you mentioned, Dan Milstein, the agent, to kind of have his own little combine in South Florida during the Stanley Cup final, when everyone was already, all the media was already there. Some teams were there. Like, it was an interesting move to kind of market his guy that way. And, you know, I've seen some sentiment out there too, that, you know, obviously we know what the political and situation is with Russia, and as it relates to the war, and as it relates to Russian involvement in IIHF tournaments, and maybe the lack of eyes that people would have on those prospects. But, you know, there is sentiment that maybe college kids are slightly risky as well, when you look at what has happened with Carter Gauthier and now maybe Rutger McGroarty in Winnipeg, that these guys have had a little bit more pushback against some organizations than some of the Russian players have. And, you know, Michkov's coming over after just the 1 year in Russia, which is, you know, honestly ahead of so many of his other peers. So, you know, the Russian factor, I think is present in a lot of the thinking that front offices do. But, you know, I wonder if maybe that starts to change, having seen some of the other, populations that they draft from, in terms of American college kids and them deciding their own future and stuff like that.
All right, let's jump to the Blues. We'll circle back to some of the other first round issues, and of course, we'll talk a little bit about the Stanley Cup outcome and some of the other free agency and trade activities that we can anticipate coming up. Some stuff we've already seen. So the Blues are sitting there in the middle of the first round. They've got to sit back and kind of watch things unfold. Some mock drafts have one of the defensemen that they would presumably like falling to them. Some don't. Some have them all gone. You've seen them go both ways. I listed out six mock drafts at five different picks for the Blues, which is kind of what happens when you're picking where they are. So, what your sense is? Is there much thought that they'll move up? Because you talked about last time the net front. It's a pretty high cost to move up if you to try to get a D-man. Or you can just settle back and take a forward that could in 3 or 4 years join the nucleus.
I mean, I think this is the perfect scenario for trading up, given their extra second round pick, their extra third round pick, where they are already starting in the first round. It's not like they're trying to trade up from 25 to 10. They're already at 16. And the deep group of defensemen in this draft, it seems like there's a lot of factors coming together at one time that could make this a unique opportunity for them to move up in the draft. Now, having said that, it's been a very difficult thing for teams to do in recent history to move up from the teens into the top 10. I looked it up, and San Jose was the last team to move from the teens to the top 10. And that was when they traded with St. Louis to move up to get Logan Couture. So it's been quite some time since a team successfully did that. Every other move into the top 10 has involved a roster player. So, you're thinking Oliver Ekman-Larsson, Alex DeBrincat, Seth Jones, those types of trades that resulted in a top 10 pick as part of the return package there. So, if you're just trading straight up picks to move up, it's not been done for quite some time. The Blues maybe would have the capital to move up a few spots, because of the trades they made at the deadline in 23. But I think they have to explore it at least and see, who's available at what spot and what the cost is, right? I think it would be malpractice not to. But yeah, it also depends on how they rank those defensemen. If they see it as a group of six or a group of eight or a group of four and then another four, like how they all tier those defensemen and how they view them and when they come off the board.
Yeah, it is interesting how the draft unfolds, especially you get down to the pick where the Blues are. I mean, Doug Armstrong talks about sometimes a lament of being at 16 and there were 15 guys you really liked and they're all gone. More typically, though, you get to 16 and there were two or three guys that got picked that weren't on your board that high, nearly that high, right? That's just the nature of this thing, especially as you get further down the list. You just don't know. And I don't know, do you get a sense of, I don't know that there's been a lot of ability to read tea leaves on teams once you get past number one. There's no mystery there. My career's already exposed that pick, and rightfully, and why not? That guy's great. You got another. He could be a better all-around player than Connor Bedard. Maybe not as explosive, but he's going to be a hell of a player. Otherwise, I don't know. Too many teams tipping their hand. I don't see it.
I think we even saw it last year a little bit, right? Like we all knew that Bedard was going one, and then the draft really started at two when Anaheim went with Carlson and Columbus went with Fantilli after that. You had no idea where Michkov was going. You saw when Arizona went off the board to get Simashev, and Montreal goes and takes Reinbacher before that. Like there were wild card moves, and it ended up that Dalibor Dvorsky falls to St. Louis at 10. And a lot of rankings or drafts or mocks had him going what 7, 8, 9 like before that. So it tends to happen as you mentioned. And I think this year at 16, you just add in an extra six teams, and you add more variability, you add more discrepancy in rankings around the league. It's just difficult to predict who's going to be there at that pitch, exactly, but. There's a group of guys that you can see there, and I know we've talked about defensemen a ton just because of the Blues' lack of defensemen in the pipeline. but it is still possible that they do go with a forward, and there should be a decent amount of forwards there available for them to take.
Yeah, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce the name, but two of the mock drafts have the Blues going for a, I guess it's a Norwegian winger who plays in Sweden. And
Michael Brandstad
all right, there you go. Well, thank you. And that's interesting. Well, we know they certainly went to that region last year and felt pretty good about it. Obviously, had Alexander Steen and was looking at a lot of players at that level while working with younger players and also watching things in Sweden this past year. So the knowledge level is pretty good of that part of the country as far as, or part of the world as far as the Blues go. I guess that would make sense. I mean, this is not somebody that would play anytime soon, but the Blues don't overpromise when it comes to that.
And I think they know what kind of pick and what kind of timeline they're getting if they do select at 16. Doug Armstrong's mentioned, like, you're looking at a guy who's coming in to the NHL in maybe 2 years, becoming a meaningful contributor in four years from right now. Like, it's not a plug and play situation, and that's part of why they don't draft on positional need in terms of the NHL roster, right? Like, they know that this person's not going to be there for a while, and they can kind of work around that timeline. I think the other interesting thing about Brandstad, Nygaard, and then also the defenseman, the Norwegian defenseman, Stian or Stian Solberg, is that they, since they come from Norway, they play in so many of the international tournaments, right? They play in World Juniors, they play in the World Championships. Like, I don't know how many draft eligible players play in the World Championships, but because they're Norwegian, and obviously they're not as their talent pool is not as stocked as Canada or the United States, they do play in those tournaments. And one thing that Doug Armstrong mentioned when we spoke to him last week was that he's been at every major international tournament. So that's Hlinka Gretzky in the fall. That's World Juniors, that's World Championships, that's U18 World Championships. Like, he's been at all of them to see all of these players. And that maybe is a delineate a departure from what he did in the past when they were drafting 25th, 26th, and you can kind of rely on your scouts a lot more. But last year, drafting 10th with two other firsts, this year, drafting 16, he's been a lot more. I don't know if involved is the right word, but a lot more knowledgeable about the players, and a lot more cognizant of going out to seeing them time and again, and not just doing a, as he calls it, one-time scouting. So, with those Norwegians in particular, I think it's noteworthy that they have been at these tournaments multiple times, and that Doug Armstrong's made a point to going to these international tournaments pretty much all year.
I think on balance, though, you can look at the Blues, and I'm going to write about this for tomorrow's newspaper and online. Over the entirety of their history, the Blues have had some really good moments in the draft. They've had some years, 1 year they didn't draft at all. They've had many years where they traded away their top picks. They've had some highlights under the Jarmo Kekäläinen period, but not enough depth. I think on balance, under Doug, and for a while it was Bill Armstrong doing the lead scouting work and analysis, they've been pretty efficient. You wrote about what they've done on with defensemen in recent drafts, and they've had some success there for sure. I think on balance, between I think most of the guys that they were hoping would develop into something have, and they've got a little bit of depth out of these drafts too. I think on balance, it seems like maybe the Blues haven't outperformed a lot of other organizations, but they've outperformed their past for sure.
Yeah, and I kind of compiled in a spreadsheet about games played, points, goals per draft pick with X amount of criteria, whether it's positionally or through the certain years. And I was looking at the defenseman that they picked, and the main takeaway for me in that position was that they have been the best team in the NHL at drafting defensemen outside the first round. We know if from 2011 to 2020, that's 10 drafts under Doug Armstrong, his first 10 drafts. They only took a defenseman one time in the first round during that time. Jordan Smoltz We know he only played 42 games in the NHL, so that obviously wasn't working out for them. But from 2 to 7, you know, they average more games played per selection of any team in the league. They average more points per selection than any team in the league, drafting defensemen from rounds 2 to 7. So that's how they've kind of weathered that. And, you know, as you mentioned on the forward side, like, they have had some picks that outperform where they were selected. Like where you look at Robert Thomas and Jordan Kyrou, Tage Thompson, if you want to throw him in there. Obviously they've had some misses. I mean, I think we can look at Dominic Bach and say he helped get you Justin Falk, but he's one of the few first round picks that never played in the NHL. It's pretty certain. I think around 90, I think I'm looking 96% of the time, if you're a forward drafted in the first round from 11 to 20, it's 96% of chance you're making the NHL. So to have Bach not make it was a, you know, obviously a detriment, but for the most part, they've done okay at finding players. Jake Neighbors, you can throw in there recently that can overperform where they're drafted, even if they don't overperform, you know, the other teams as a whole.
This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1-3 and 7-day passes. Watch the chase for the cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
Hey, by the way, full shout out for the Blues getting away from the Deutschland Dangler. That was a nickname for Bach, the Deutschland Dangler. Got out from that. And they knew there was trouble right away when they were going to, like, just getting him to come out of Europe and play at a level that might test him a little bit. One of the many picks over the years, that skill is one thing. Kapokako looking at you and then making it work is another. And so, but they got out from underneath that one. So that was a plus. I want to touch while we mentioned that, I want to touch on a couple of guys that the Blues did take and got some mileage out of, have had sort of contrasting fates to a degree. First of all, I was surprised the Red Wings had to throw a second round pick to move Jake Walman. Now, I know that Walman's aggregate numbers were better than his performance. I mean, the underlying statistics on him weren't very good. He ended up playing a lot because of circumstances and had a good pairing in Detroit, but, you know, still, having said all of that, to have to spend a second round pick just to unload his cap hit seemed a little extreme.
Yeah, it wasn't like it was a real albatross of a deal anyway. Right. 2 more years at 3.4, he's basically making what he should be making. It wasn't he wasn't a negative asset, I guess would be the best way to put it, right?
We've seen worse.
Yeah. And you see the price that they paid to just get rid of him. And it felt like that would have been a sort of deal they would have done with a guy like, you know, Ben Sherrod or Justin Hull, those types of deals they have on their roster, and not Jake Walman. And if they still want to do those Hull and Sherrod deals, well, guess what? That price is a lot higher now because of the price they set with Walman. So I think everyone was kind of confused by that deal, including a lot of the people in Detroit. But, you know, on the other side, you know, San Jose is making making interesting moves, you know, picking up some buy low candidates, so to speak. I mean, I don't even know if you'd say that Walman was a buy low candidate, but they got an extra asset for taking him anyway. But, you know, getting Ty Dellandrea to kind of add some physicality to their bottom six, obviously claiming Barclay Goodrow, that contract is not going to hurt the Sharks in particular. It would hurt a lot of teams around the league, but it won't hurt them because of their situation. So they've made interesting moves, and obviously they're going to make their biggest one tomorrow night when they pitch Celebrini. But I don't really understand the Walman trade, and we'll see what else they have to get done, the Red Wings. And obviously we know they have to sign Mort Sider, but there has to be some other explanation as to why they felt the absolute need to get out of this contract by giving away a second round pick.
Yeah, I mean, again, they positioned him. They gave him some prime opportunity, at least again, to put up some aggregate numbers and play some minutes. And given his age, he's still in his prime, obviously. I mean, Jake would drive you crazy at times. When he makes a mistake, he makes a mistake. I mean, it's a bad mistake, okay? But that's a lot of guys. He goes to San Jose. They're going to turn the page, I guess, on Kalen Addison. They took a run at him. Obviously, the Wild said no mas with him, sent him over there. The Sharks said no mas. He apparently makes Scott Perunovich look like a Norris Trophy candidate when it comes to playing his own end. So away he goes. And another one to give a shout out to, JT and I loved Nico back in the day. He's a cup winner. And, good on him for he and 91, now 10, for getting a Stanley Cup.
I mean, it's he was a really he brought an element to that defensive core in Florida, Nico Mikkola, that they didn't really have a ton of after Radko Gudas left. And you can see that core, and that would be the probably defense core that Doug Armstrong was trying to build when he said, all right, we're gonna let the number one defenseman walk. We're gonna fill it with three or four number two or number threes. And that's what Florida was able to do successfully. We can argue about this, who's a number one or not, but it doesn't seem like Florida has one. They have a bunch of really good top pairing guys, Forsling, Ekblad, throw Montour in there. And they have a lot of variety in their skills, similar to kind of how Carolina built their blue line, a lot of variety in skills. And Nico Mikkola brought that penalty killing aspect, and him and Kulikov basically were the defensive defensemen of that group. And then you looked at Montour, Ekman Larson as the offensive guys, Ekblad and Forsling as the two-way sort of guys, and then that's kind of how Florida survived without a number one. And I think if you looked at this, the moves that Doug Armstrong made in trying to build a defense core that didn't have a number one, I think you would say that would have been the dream scenario to build something like Florida did. Obviously, we know that didn't happen, but to see Mikkola do what he did down there was good for him, and obviously the Panthers needed his services to kind of fill a gap of skill in other areas of their defense corps.
Yeah, that was an interesting year for that group because Montour coming back from the shoulder injury was not the same guy. He got a lot of minutes. He got the same power play usage. He got a lot of the same opportunity, offensive zone starts and such. It just wasn't productive, and not like he was the year before, going from being about a point a game to about a half point a game. Ekblad just had a million injuries. That poor guy. He's been through the mill. And I'm, by the way, much love to Barkov and Ekblad for winning their cup because they saw some lean times
Oh
there
yeah.
when nobody was coming to the games. Firsthand, you were there. Nobody's coming to their games.
Yeah, it's actually wild for me, 'cause I grew up in South Florida. The 96 run for me was when I was a small child and going to games at the Miami Arena, and thinking about those days, and then when I covered them, and I guess this was 17, 18, like the turnover has been incredible. The change in the organization has been complete 180. Basically, the only parts of the organization that stayed have been, owner, the president of the business side, and Barkov and Ekblad. And like across the last 6 years, basically everything has changed from that. Like the coach has changed, I want to say, three times. I mean, I covered Bob Boudner in Florida, and they since went to I guess it was Quenneville Brunette, and Maurice. They've changed general managers from Talon to Zito. A lot of the hockey operations staff has changed. The roster, that was a roster that was built around Bjugstad and Trocheck, Huberdeau, Barkov, and Ekblad, and now that whole roster has been changed over besides Barkov and Ekblad. And there's a sandwich chain in South Florida called Miami Subs. They used to literally give away Panthers tickets. You buy a sandwich, they give you Panthers tickets over the counter. And like that was, way back in the day. where the Panthers were struggling to draw a crowd. And even 5 years ago, there was questions about whether they would ever be a cap team. They were losing probably close to $20 million a year, and they weren't spending to the cap. They had just gone through the expansion draft fiasco of sending Riley Smith, Jonathan Marchessault, and Gerard Gallant all to Vegas, watching them go to the Cup final as they missed the playoffs again. Like, they had gone through a lot of that and questions about financial stability, and to see what they've done is actually pretty remarkable. And then the turnover that they've been able to do and turn them into a winner down there.
Now, as a young Panthers fan, did you have your own collection of plastic rats from the to, in honor of that game?
I didn't have the rats. I did have, a few jerseys, a few hats, and we would go out to practices. Like I see, families go out to Centene to watch the Blues practice, and that's something that my dad and I would do from time to time. And we'd go to the Panthers practice facility and watch, Bill Lindsay practice out there, and even Scott Mellenby, who's now part of the Blues hockey operations staff. So it's been a journey for Panthers fans who have been through that whole thing for across the last 30 years.
And by the way, for fans who don't know why all those rats were on the ice, you can blame Mellenby for that. So it was a famous his famous turning point where the Cardinals had a rally squirrel, the Panthers had a rat and had to pay the price with a vigorous shot by Mellenby. Because
It
I
did.
tell you what, I only covered one game at the old Miami Arena with the Panther, and man, what a dump! Unfortunately, for at the end, that arena was kind of at the end back in the day, and it was a little rough. Down there in Overton, it was a little chippy down there. The building wasn't the best, and those were tough times. I know the Blues stayed out of Fort Lauderdale on a resort, and then rolled into the city to play that and got the hell out as quick as they could. Those were little bleak times. But one of my favorite guys of all time, Doug McClain, coaching that team, and they made that run, and it was so cool. But then all those years, all that bleak time, you're growing up watching bad hockey, man.
Yeah, and even like the 96 series, when they beat the Penguins in the conference final, like that was their last series win for 25 years, I want to say, like up until recently when they were able to get into the second round, I think, after they beat Washington a few years ago. I think that was their first series win since 96. And of course, we know like what happened in 96, they get swept by Colorado. And so it had been some time for Panthers fans to enjoy this, and I'm happy that they have something.
Yeah, and I'm happy for 91 now 10. I was reading that he bought a nice $5 million home on the ocean, so he's upgraded there. His family settled there. He's got another cup. And in my message to Blues fans again, and I've written about this is, be happy for the guy. He did what he set out to do here. He did everything this franchise hoped he would do. It's a shame it didn't last forever. But it's a shame Pietrangelo didn't stay forever. It's a shame a lot of things don't happen. That Ryan O'Reilly couldn't finish his career here. That David Perron's moved on 14 times. I mean, it's just. It happens, all right? So be happy for 91. Obviously be happy for Matthew Tkachuk and the Tkachuks. And your thoughts watching Big Walt just kind of doing what any dad would do, right? When this happens. I mean, as you'll know go in due time that anything you do in life will is great, but if your kids do something great, it's so much better. And that was pretty cool watching Walt kind of come unglued.
Yeah, and to me, like the shot of their family suite, and they're all just kind of singing along with the arena tunes, and seeing the emotion on their faces, like that was special. And then I enjoyed seeing Brady's reaction, because like that's a division rival that he's cheering that just won the Stanley Cup, but it's his brother, right? And knowing what he did last year when Matthew was going through his injuries, and he's worried about his brother having trouble breathing and having to dress him and get him ready for playoff, cup final games, like having gone through that last year, seeing what his brother went through, to watching him a year later celebrate winning the Stanley Cup, that's got to be gratifying for Brady to see his brother do that, and motivating on the other side to want that for himself. And I'm sure it was you're kind of playing a game of locate the cup if you're Brady, right? You don't want to get too close to it. You don't want to accidentally touch it. You don't want to bring that bad juju. So I'm sure he was being cognizant of where it was in his surroundings as well.
By the way, that'll be a hell of a party when the Cup makes its STL visit. The Kachucks will throw a party. It'll don't
Yeah.
worry about it. It'll be fun. I think they'll have fun. Again, Brady, keep your distance. Now, segueing back to hockey, Brady's also happy because they got a goaltender now, and Ullmark seems pretty okay with this. Obviously, he has to sign off that this is going to be a good thing. He's not sure he wants an extension, but he's good to go. He wants to be number one goalie again. Ottawa's got a lot of talent. Last year was a fiasco. And just ask me, because I had Korpisalo as my second goaltender on my fantasy team for a while. That was awful. And I'm shocked the Bruins took back Korpisalo even at a reduced rate and all that. I guess they figure they can save him or do something with him. And moving Ullmark, then the prices that teams got for their goaltenders, not great. And but they're very good news for Ottawa fans.
Yeah, I think that was my big takeaway from, I mean, we talked about the Markstrom deal on the last podcast, and now we're talking about the Ullmark deal. And my reaction to Markstrom was that was it. Like that was the deal that they waited from the trade deadline to now to complete. And with Ullmark, you also look at that and say you got pick number 25 and Mark Kastelic and a bad goaltender at a reduced rate. Like it seemed like the goaltending market wasn't as inflated as we would have thought. And even on a much different scale, we can look at Darcy Kemper and Pierre-Luc Dubois. Like, yes, the trade was about Dubois. Darcy Kemper had a bad year last year, but this was a Stanley Cup winning goaltender not too long ago that just got traded for one of the worst contracts in the league. So the goaltending market as a whole, I think, has underwhelmed. Now that's not to say that it can't change. I think we all look at the prices that Detroit in particular, we talk about Wallman, the prices teams paid to get rid of contracts, and that's probably higher than we think, and the goaltending market's lower than we think, and somehow it all is one trade market. So we'll just have to monitor and see if there's any other goaltenders out there that get moved at maybe a higher price.
Yeah, as far as Pierre-Luc Dubois goes, he says, well, no hard feelings about this. Well, dude, you were horrible. You got paid all the money in the world, and you're horrible. And you earned every bit of that demotion down to the a minimized third line role. Of course, there's no hard feelings. You got paid to go live on the beach and play half-assed hockey, man. Great. I'm glad you're not holding any hard feelings. If I'm Rob Blake, I'm holding hard feelings because now I got a goaltender I like, so I'm okay. And I got rid of that contract without having to pay for it out of my own wallet. So that's which the owner might have wanted him to do. All right,
Yeah.
hey, last thing on that front before you head off today, the Blues are under the radar. You're hearing a lot of there's a lot of chit chat around the league right now, things people waiting for big things to happen. But so far it's been quiet, and as Matt DeFranks thinks it's just going to continue to stay quiet.
Yeah, I mean the messaging from Tom Stillman and Doug Armstrong the entire time has been, don't expect anything big. Don't be thinking it's maybe a splashy acquisition. So I think that is the mentality that I am thinking of throughout this summer. They do have enough cap space to be able to make a move, to be able to absorb a bad contract if they needed, to be able to retain salary on another deal if they needed to. Like they have some flexibility that way. I think if they wanted to, they probably could have done the Ilya Mikheyev trade that Vancouver and Chicago just did. Obviously they didn't do that one, but I think they have some room to do something like that, and if they're able to get an extra asset. And I think that should be maybe the goal here is to do moves like that to find extra assets and to fill out the depth.
Which was not good enough last year. So we'll leave it at that. For Matt DeFranks, I'm Jeff Gordon. This has been the NetFront Presence. A reminder, if you're hearing this on your podcast app, first of all, tell your friends about it. And number two, if you're hearing us on the app, then make sure you check out the website. Lots of video, a lot of extra content. A lot of cool stuff that's not in our very fine print edition. We do appreciate all of you who do support local journalism. We're in there fighting every day, trying to provide as much coverage as we can. So until next time, until we return after the draft and with free agency rolling, for Matt, I'm Jeff. See ya.